Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we're going to have as a returning guest John Eidsmo, who's an attorney who's written a three-volume series on the history of law. And we're going to focus today on a gentleman named Sir William Blackstone, who might not be a household name in America, but he really ought to be because he had such a great influence on not only our laws, but also the laws of England. And John, I welcome you back to the program. So great to have you on the program.
Always good to be with you, Jerry. I certainly appreciate your books and your ability to get the word out to the American people. And you're right, Blackstone maybe is not as much a household word in America today, but back at the time this nation was founded, in fact, at that time, Edmund Burke of the English Parliament said that Blackstone's commentaries probably sold more copies in America than they did in England, because here we just needed to have it in writing rather than rely on an oral tradition like they could in England. Also said that many an argument in an early American court was settled simply by a quote from Blackstone.
And I understand that even to this day, the Supreme Court has been quoting Blackstone through the centuries and even still sometimes today.
That certainly is true. In fact, we have today what we call the Westlaw and Lexis computer searches, where you can put in words or names into the computer and they'll come out with cases of record, that is, state Supreme Court and then federal district circuit and U.S. Supreme Court decisions. And I have run a Westlaw search on Blackstone, and I found that Blackstone has been cited by the Supreme Court in at least cited by courts of record in at least 20,780 cases.
Oh, wow.
And that includes over 6,000 from 1789 to 1899, in other words, basically the century of the 1800s. Also 6,000 from 1900 to 1959, and 7,500 from 1960 through 2011.
Wow.
And so, obviously, the court still looks to Blackstone.
But that's so interesting to me because, and by the way, just one quick anecdote about Blackstone, and then want to get into the Christian side of things here. And that is, it's my understanding that when he was a young man, Abraham Lincoln received or acquired a copy of one of the volumes of Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, and by reading it, he became so familiar with the laws that he eventually became a lawyer and then, of course, went on to become President of the United States.
And I can tell you one that went the opposite direction, too, and that was Charles Finney. Charles Finney, you know, was a famous evangelist in the early 1800s, and he was first a lawyer and an unbeliever. But he started reading Blackstone's commentaries and other ancient works on law, ancient English works on law, and he said it was just so amazing to him that they were referring constantly to Scripture. And so he decided he needed to get a Bible, and he got a Bible, read it, became a Christian, and a lot of the modern methods of revivalism that we have are based on Charles Finney.
Wow, interesting. So by any stretch of anybody's imagination, including a humanistic one, Sir William Blackstone was definitely influential. And he lived in...
Very much so. In fact, here's something interesting, too, that in the 1700s, the first edition of Blackstone's commentaries to be published in America was being published. And in those days, when you were going to print a large work, commonly what you would do is you would sell subscriptions to it in advance. You wanted to make sure that you'd get enough people who agreed to buy it, that it would be a profitable venture for you. And so the first edition has at the beginning 1,000 names of the first subscribers. And this is virtually a who's who in 18th century America. You have people who become constitutional convention delegates, you have lawyers, you have politicians, you also have pastors, doctors, and other people in various fields of relative importance. And like I say, Blackstone subscribers is a virtual who's who in America of the day.
Such as, can you just throw out a few names?
Well, I'll give you a few names here. In fact, I've cited some of these names here in the third volume of Historical and Theological Foundations of Law, John Adams, for one,
yeah,
and Gunning Bedford, who was a delegate to the convention, Reverend Nicholas Bedgood, Judge John Raven, Elias Boudinot, who was a president of the Continental Congress, William Bradford, who was the Attorney General of New Providence, and I can go on and list a lot of other names here, but that gives you a little flavor.
Sure. So Sir William Blackstone lived when? And I know he lived in England.
Born
probably
in 1723, lived until 1780. His commentaries were published in England in the 1760s, I believe, and the American edition was published in 1772.
Did you say he was born in 1723 and then died in 1780?
That's right. In other words, he was 56 or 57 years old, which,
wow,
you know, that's a relatively short lifetime by today's
yeah,
standards, and
absolutely,
yet do you think how much he accomplished during that time?
Yeah, that's amazing.
One thing else about his influence, too, Jerry, and that's there's another man. That is James Kent, who is the Chancellor of the High Court of New York. Now, Kent is famous today for his commentaries on American law. And Kent describes how when he was 15 years old and a freshman at Yale, that he read all four of Blackstone's commentaries at age 15 at Yale and was so impressed by them that that was part of his determination to become a lawyer and a judge. And if you look to his four-volume commentaries on American law, they are patterned pretty much after Blackstone's commentaries, and some referred to Kent as the American Blackstone.
Wow. Wow, so this guy's really, really influential. Now, what is the link between Sir William Blackstone and his writings and thinking and our founding fathers? And maybe before we get into that, why don't you talk a little bit about Sir William Blackstone and Christianity, his Christian thoughts?
Blackstone was a very devout Anglican, that is, of the Church of England. And Blackstone, in Volume 1, particularly in the introductory portion of his commentaries, talks about the categories of law. And first of all, he says there is what we call the law of nature. And by the law of nature, he says, this is Blackstone's words now, the will of his maker, called the law of nature, for his God, when he established matter and endued it with the principle of mobility, established certain rules for the perpetual direction of that motion, so when he created man and endued him with free will to conduct himself in all parts of life, he laid down certain immutable laws of human nature. Then he goes on to talk about how this natural law, the law of nature, is, he says, coeval with mankind and dictated by God himself and, of course, superior in obligation to any other. It is binding over all the globe, in all countries, and at all times. No human laws are of any validity if contrary to this.
Wow.
And such of them as are valid derive all their force and all their authority, mediately or immediately, from this original. But then he goes on to talk about how, because sometimes our minds are a little unclear, we have, first of all, a limited intellect, so we don't always understand this law of nature, which he says is the law of God. And because of the depravity of our will, sometimes we don't even follow that which we do understand. So he says God also took some of his law of nature and put it in writing in the form of Scripture. And so he says the doctrines thus delivered we call the revealed or divine law, and they are to be found only in the Holy Scriptures. And he says, upon these two foundations, the law of nature and the law of revelation, depend all human laws. That is to say, no human laws should be suffered to contradict these. Now, one thing else, what about the relationship between the law of nature and this revealed law of Scripture? Well, he says they're both part of the law of God. And so he says, if we could be as sure of the one as we are of the other, they would be of equal force and effect. But he says, undoubtedly, the revealed law is of infinitely more authenticity than the moral system, which is framed by ethical writers and denominated the natural law, because one is the law of nature expressly declared to be so by God himself, The other is only what, by the assistance of human reason, we imagine to be that law. In other words, we know in black and white what the Scripture says. Part of the law of nature, that's by our best reason. And so he says, if we could be as certain of the latter as we are of the former, both would have an equal authority, but till then, they can never be put in any competition together. In other words, because Scripture is clear and law of nature might be a little confusing, when there is any possible question about the law of nature, we go with Scripture.
Isn't that interesting? And by the way, the phrase, the laws of nature and of nature's God, are in a sense Blackstonian. When Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about the moral law, and that no human law should contradict the moral law revealed by God, he's being Blackstonian in a sense, right?
Very Blackstonian, and so was Jefferson. When Jefferson, in the Declaration of Independence, says that we are entitled to our independence, he bases our independence on the laws of nature and of nature's God. Now, that is almost a direct quote from Blackstone.
Isn't that interesting? So, comment more then on Blackstone and the Founding Fathers of America. How influential was he?
Well, there is a most interesting study that came out in 1984 in the American Political Science Review. It's by Dr. Donald Lutz and Dr. Charles Heinemann. And these professors had researched thousands of documents of American figures from 1760 to 1805, the founding era. And they pored over these documents. These are diaries and letters and speeches and essays and treatises and other such things. They pored over these to identify quotations, to see who the Founding Fathers were quoting and where they got their ideas. And they found the most widely quoted source was the Bible. That was 34% of all quotations.
Mm-hmm.
And the two second most highly quoted were Baron Montesquieu of France and Sir William Blackstone, almost the same. Montesquieu just slightly more than Blackstone, but I think Blackstone, in terms of his actual influence, would be more.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? And then the third one would be John Locke. But as you say,
John Locke is down quite a bit. But it's interesting that all three of these are essentially within the Christian camp. Montesquieu, a devout Catholic, and John Locke, of a Puritan background and maybe not 100% Orthodox, but basically in the Christian camp, and Blackstone being Anglican.
Well, having put together this amazing series of books on the historical and theological foundations of law in three volumes, doing all this research, and it all went through your brain, John Eisenman. You're brilliant, by the way. I really appreciate that.
Well, it only passed through it.
Anyway, you're a humble law professor. So anyway, when it's all said and done, Sir William Blackstone would be among the most influential of all commentators on law throughout history, correct?
Certainly in the Anglo-American tradition, he would be.
Yeah.
In fact, I think if you were just to take people from England and America, I couldn't name any Englishman or American who would be more influential than Blackstone. But now one thing Blackstone does, too, is he's quite a historian. And Blackstone goes back to say that we shouldn't just look to Roman law as our source. We should be looking back to our old Anglo-Saxon laws, the laws of Alfred and the laws of Edward and the other laws of the old Anglo-Saxons. And he also says that when judges are deciding cases, they are not making law. That's one thing you often hear today when a new precedent is set. The court just made some law today.
Yeah.
No, they didn't. The courts don't make law, Blackstone said. The courts discover and reveal law. I like to use the analogy.
We have 20 seconds left.
Sculpture. You think of Michelangelo, who said, I am revealing what is inside that stone, the Statue of David. Blackstone would say that's what the judge does. He doesn't make the law, create it. He reveals it.
Excellent. And on that point, we'll end. Historical and Theological Foundations of Law in Three Volumes by John Eidsmo, E-I-D-S-M-O-E, morallaw.org for more information. John, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure.
And thank you, Jerry. Keep getting the word out.
All right. God bless you now. Bye-bye.